Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian, the podcast that's speeding down the technology motorway, breaking the speed limit, and not using a hands-free kit. Well, nothing illegal, but let's carry on anyway. My name's Bobby Johnson, and for the last month or two, I've been at the wheel, standing in for Alex Kwiatkowski while she's been away, preparing her latest TV escapade, and probably more importantly, finishing her PhD. However, I'm about to become a backseat driver as we introduce a new member of the Tech Weekly team, a new voice to the programme, and hopefully someone who doesn't have to present the show from their wardrobe every week. Tech Weekly listeners, let me introduce you to Susie Weezer, who'll be driving the bus from now on. Hello, Susie.
Hello. I should probably point out at this point, I don't have a driving licence.
I didn't have one until last year, you know, now I'm a grown-up. I can drive a car. Anyway, it's at times like this when we normally have to shuffle about awkwardly, look at each other a bit coyly, and then I ask you a fact about yourself. So tell me, what's your claim to fame?
My claim to fame would be that when the iPhone was originally launched in New York, all that long time ago, I got a kiss and a cuddle from the man who was at the front of the queue 5 days after he'd started queuing on telly.
That's good.
But seeing as how I'm in charge now, let me turn the tables. Bobby, what's your party trick?
This is the point where I think I'm supposed to pretend I'm desperately interesting, which is going to be difficult. Let me think. In a kind of technological sense, I have now discovered over the weekend that I'm very good at seeing, understanding what people say backwards on a video. Don't ask how. On another note, I once almost knocked Annika Rice over at the theatre. Does that count? Is that interesting?
That definitely counts. As well as Bobby lending his words of both wisdom and punnery and Annika knocking down skills, we're joined today by The Guardian's technological oracle, Charles Arthur, who will be here to delve further into the stories coming up today. Charles, what mark have you left on the history books?
Well, there was a sort of pencil mark on page 3 of one of them. But I mean, no, the thing I really that I carry proudly is the fact that during the dot-com boom, an analysis was done of all the technology journalists' coverage of the dot-com boom, and I was judged to be the most sceptical about the first dot-com boom. And I think history's proved me right.
Not bad. Now, this week, you can look forward to finding out how and why you'd hack Anton Deck's games console of choice, something these builders have taken full advantage of because presumably driving 10-ton diggers isn't exciting enough.
Hello, my name's Simon, and this is Bender and Fender, our 15-ton grapples. That's 15 tons each. Of course, we're not content just to use regular control devices for these grapples, so we decided one afternoon we should control them with a Wiimote.
Podcast being a primarily audio thing, you'll have to take my word for the fact that that was pretty spectacular. But you can see it for yourself by checking out guardian.co.uk/techweekly. But there's more. We'll also be finding out why the latest financial results have put the frighteners on some mobile phone manufacturers. And we'll see if YouTube spells an end for Channel 4's 4OD service. So, shamelessly stealing Bobby's motoring analogy, you had better buckle up as we take you on a 30-minute Jens and Button-style tour of the technology world. Since its launch, Nintendo's Wii games console has become a favourite not just with families, but with hackers, who immediately saw the potential in the gesture-based controls of the Wiimote. Today, we're joined in the studio by Jan Sesnik, who has pioneered some of the most advanced, and from what I can see, fun, musical hacking. Hello, Jan.
Hello.
He's the man behind the Wii Loop machine, which allows people to create musical masterpieces using their Wii remote. Based on loops of sound, it allows you to add and manipulate them using gestures that you'll be familiar with if you've ever used the Nintendo Wii, bringing a whole new meaning to the phrase performance art. Jan, can you explain to us what modifications you've made to the Wii to create this program?
Well, to the Wii itself, I haven't done anything. The Wii Remote, I just buy them from the store, which is kind of the best part about it. They're relatively cheap, and if I wanted to build something like this myself, it would cost well more than the £30 or however much they cost now. So the trick has mostly been on the software end of things and getting it connected to a computer. It uses Bluetooth. So once you get the Wii Remote paired with the computer, then you can get all the data. Now, there's a bunch of different tools you can use for that. What I use is a software package called MaxMSP, which is designed mostly for music and visual creative people. It's kind of a cheating way to program stuff because it's relatively easy to do. And then it's once you have all the data, it's mostly a question of what to do with it. You have so much data coming in, the X, Y, the Z, the infrared, the buttons. There's tons you can do, and it's about building an interface that lets you actually do something particular. So in my case, mess around with music and make crazy sounds.
I see. So was it the simplicity of the Wii Remote that drew you to it and the wide range of things you could do with it in the first place?
Yeah. I mean, it's romance. As I tend to say this a lot, but motion control is a very romantic notion in the field of digital arts, in particular music. There's been, you know, since the theremin, and then going by way of Jean-Michel Jarre and those kinds of people, you have tons of people who always want to move and create music. And I definitely got caught up in that. And once when the Wii Remote came out and it had motion control systems built in and buttons and infrared and all that for £30, it's kind of hard to turn down.
And is hacking something you've always been interested in? Is there a big community for beginners to get involved in?
There is now with the Wii Remotes, definitely. I'm definitely a musician initially. For example, the MaxMSP is built by a guy in Japan named Masayuki Akamatsu, and he just made this system and then put it online, and you can get it and install it yourself. And there's tons of things like that for any software library, you name it. You can figure out a way to find the community that will help you figure out the way to connect the Wii Remote and make stuff for it.
It sounds like the sort of thing you should be doing next is turning it into a Wii game, because it has to be said that Wii Music on the Wii is a lamentable piece of software that I'm amazed that they had the effrontery to put out.
I feel very strongly about Wii Music. I've actually wrote a big long review about it on my website if you're interested. I really desperately would love to get something like this onto either Wii console, or there are several other consoles now using motion control, or will be soon. It's a funny story because I started a company around all this stuff to commercialize the Loot Machine and get it out to market. And I got a lot of support from various people in Edinburgh where I live. And it was all going very well. And I ended up going on Dragon's Den. They really liked the idea. They were actually very nice to me. It was loads of fun. But they didn't see the potential as a commercial project. And at one point, this didn't make the final show, but at one point, Peter Jones even said, in a sort of sarcastic, snarky voice, after he had just played with it and said it sounded fun and was very cool, he said, "So you're saying my kids would just want to come down and from their rooms and play music?" And I thought, well, that's the last prompt thing I thought was an issue. playing music has been around for thousands of years. It's not – people will be interested in playing music. So anyway, I didn't get the money, but I ended up working out some – I can't really talk about it, unfortunately, but I did end up working with a games company in the end. It didn't come to fruition, unfortunately, again. I've learned a lot about how challenging it is to get something onto the console. To get onto the Nintendo console, you have to have a license, and it is relatively easy comparatively to Sony or Xbox to get a license for Nintendo. But you basically need games development experience. And I'm a musician. I'm a piano player, And so I had never done game development. And that's, I think, was my advantage in terms of designing software that is something totally new, that would be something far better than Wii Music. But I keep hitting roadblocks.
MaxMSP is a bit of a challenge, isn't it? I saw Imogen Heap, who's a musician who's uses huge amounts of technology. I saw a tweet from her the other night saying, I wish I had the time to learn MaxMSP. I got the impression it's just too big. It's just too complex.
I love it, but I had the luxury of learning MaxMSP in whilst doing a master's in sound design at the University of Edinburgh, and it's very MaxMSP focused. So it was, I had the time and the motivation to do it then. I'm not sure I would have otherwise, because it's, real programmers tend to laugh at something like MaxMSP because it doesn't have, all these classes you can do in programming, and you can't do all this really cool stuff that you can. But for somebody like me who's visual and I like to connect little boxes, that's how it works. It's a graphical programming interface. You have little boxes, you connect them up, and then it starts doing things. It's a brilliant way. And the best part for me is that once you've made something in MaxMSP, you can make a piece of standalone software out of it, and you can sell that piece of standalone software out of it for free. You don't have to pay them a licensing fee. You don't have to do anything.
There seems to be a very strong correlation between the music community and the hacker community. There's quite a lot of crossover. Why do you think that is?
My personal explanation for this, I get in trouble for this amongst the music electronic music crowd sometimes, is that it because electronic music performance really sucks right now. It's really boring. And that, you know, you have people. I did a gig last night and I hated myself for it because I was sitting in front of my laptop and I was playing. And I wasn't using Wii Remotes or anything. It was a particular project I was doing. So there's no spectacle in electronic music. And there's no kind of human element to it. It's very, very sterile. And I think something like the Wii Remote offers something that's been really missing from music technology in particular. Because, you know, people who produce music on computers and digitally and everything, ultimately, deep down inside, subconsciously, they really just want to play instruments. And that's fine. That's great. And there's amazing stuff you can do on a computer. And it's brilliant. That's why I've started doing it. But at the same time, you lose something. You do lose that kind of tactile, I want to play with this and move it. And I think it adds a lot. I've actually found when I play concerts with the Wii Remote, people are 10 times more interested in the show. And they come up and they say, wow, I love the music that you made and you were moving around, and is that a Wii Remote? And yeah, there's a bit of a gimmick to it. But you know, the trick is to make good music out of it as well. And if it's bad music, people will dismiss it as a gimmick.
Yeah, and if people want to find out more about what you're doing, where can they go?
There's two main websites. You can go to WiiLoopMachine.com. That's where I kind of center all of my Wii Remote projects, at least the commercial ones. And also there's tons of free stuff there to download as well. I also have my own personal website, which is theamazingrolo.net with one L. Everybody in Britain spells it with two L's.
Blame the chocolate.
Yeah, right. I do.
Well, that's brilliant. Thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
And no doubt there will be a whole generation of musical hackers checking that stuff out as we speak. Now Bobby's here to whip us through the technological movers and shakers making the headlines in the last 7 days.
Microsoft is hoping that it can shrug off the struggles of the PC industry to make its mark with the official launch of Windows 7 this week. The system, which comes 2.5 years after the launch of Vista, will go on sale to the general public on Thursday in what many experts suggest is a critical period for the company. Finnish mobile giant Nokia reported its biggest losses in more than a decade, while rival Sony Ericsson also took a beating thanks to the recession and increased competition from rivals like the iPhone and the BlackBerry. Nokia lost around £830 million in the last quarter, despite being the biggest mobile manufacturer in the world, as it continued to concede ground in the lucrative smartphone market. On the subject of mobile phones, gadget fans are keeping a close eye on the new Motorola handset known as the Droid, which has been developed in conjunction with Google. The touchscreen handset, which also sports a physical keyboard and runs a 2.0 version of the Android operating system, has been hailed by one gadget blog as the most impressive phone since the iPhone. And Channel 4 made some history last week by forging a deal with YouTube that will see the website show full-length programs from the broadcaster free of charge. As well as offering downloads through its own 4OD service, Channel 4 viewers can turn to the web to watch episodes of shows like Skins, Peep Show, and Hollyoaks.
Thank you, Bobby. Beautifully summarised. Now, as you said, Windows 7 is launching next week. Charles, have you had a chance to play with it? What are your thoughts?
I've only sort of seen it over people's shoulders, principally Rory Kathleen Jones of the BBC. It looks rather like Vista, I have to say, in many ways, but all the reports are that it's slightly less cumbersome than Vista. And I don't have any particular opinions. I think it's intriguing that rather like Apple did when it's moved from Leopard to Snow Leopard recently, Windows 7 seems to be Vista with all the extra dingles and dongles and dangles taken out.
Bobby, what about yourself? Are you excited about this next launch?
It's always interesting when you get one of these big launches, but I think even Microsoft themselves kind of admit, or certainly admitted to me in the past, that a lot of this is a marketing push, really, to kind of wipe away the stain of Vista and get back on track I noticed this week that Steve Ballmer said one of the best things was all of the touch interface stuff that they've built in. Frankly, I mean, how many people use touch-sensitive Windows PCs at the moment? Hardly anybody. So really, they're touting these amazingly fringe parts of the system as the big deal, which they may prove to be, you know, a few years down the line, but not today. Today it's an attempt to just get themselves back on track, I think.
I mean, it could be interesting if Windows 7 turns out to have the sort of lifespan that XP has had. XP is still going strong for many people, 8 years after it was first launched. So if we're talking about it in 2017, you can imagine there could be touch-sensitive devices out there being used for computing that, maybe Windows 7 with the whole touch interface thing will actually have started something off.
Talking of touchscreens, actually, there was a story in there about both Nokia and Sony Ericsson's results. And some have said that it's because they don't have a really killer touchscreen phone, either of them, that can go up against something like the iPhone. What do you think? Can you blame it on the wider economic downturn, or is it something specific to these companies that they're doing wrong?
I mean, to say they don't have a killer touchscreen phone, they don't even have a sort of slightly harmful touchscreen phone. The problem is, it's sort of twofold. They don't have a really good smartphone, and they don't have a very good app store. In the case of Sony Ericsson, I don't think they really have what you would call an app store at all, something that third-party developers can easily get products to the users of the phones to. And these days, as Michael Gartenberg, the analyst, says, having an app store is basically your table stake if you're going to be in the smartphone game, and the smartphones is where the money is. The trouble for Nokia and Sony Ericsson is phones don't wear out like they used to. People get a good enough phone contract, well, you know, they're just going to continue with it. I've had the same Sony Ericsson phone for years.
Bobby, Motorola seemed to have brought themselves back from the brink somewhat by launching some interesting Android-based devices. Do you think we could see something like that from Nokia or Sony Ericsson?
I'm really interested to see what happens with Motorola because, it's been a few years since the Razr came out. Massive hit at the time. And then the iPhone came along and everyone looked at the Razr and thought it looked like a piece of crap. Comparatively, we've just got some more details about Verizon's the US mobile operator's deal with Motorola to launch a new phone called the Droid, which is based on Android. All the reports so far say it's pretty good. Verizon's 45% owned by Vodafone, so we might see something come out in the UK fairly soon. I think Nokia's been messing about mainly with its software. Symbian is not doing the trick for it, so it's come up with this new stuff called MIMO. Sony Ericsson, God knows what's going on with them, frankly. I think that the trouble is now the European mobile manufacturers look behind the game, and that's never been the position they've been in before. They've always been, you know, one step ahead of America. Now they're not. I think they're finding it really hard to cope, and frankly, I don't see any way back in the short term, at least, because they haven't got brilliant devices coming up, and that's what it's all about.
Absolutely. And so onto YouTube, they've traditionally been the place to find shorter clips. Do you think they can turn themselves into a destination for full-length programmes in the mind of the internet?
I don't know. Could you watch a full-length thing on YouTube? Probably. I don't see why not, apart from maybe some quality issues, but I'm sure they'll sort those out along the way. Hulu, iPlayer, they've shown that people are okay with watching this stuff on their computers. Channel 4 is a commercial company, but it does have a public service remit, so it can kind of get away with doing deals like this and not worry too much. On the other hand, Google is desperate, absolutely desperate, to try and sell good advertising against YouTube videos. It can't do that very well with sneezing pandas and stuff like that. So getting actual proper programs in there is brilliant for them. So really, other TV companies might argue this, but I think for everyone involved, from, you know, the viewers, Channel 4 and Google, there's nothing really wrong with this deal. I mean, it gives us what we want, and maybe they get something out of it too.
Very cleverly, I think, for Channel 4, effectively, they've got the iPlayer infrastructure without having to pay for any of it. They just, you know, upload it to YouTube. It's a very clever, very economical way of doing it. I mean, we don't know about the money changing hands behind the scenes, but one suspects that there's just as much benefit to Channel 4 from doing this as there is to Google from having it. So it's pretty much a win-win and no money changing hands sort of deal.
It's important to point out as well that this is a slightly backfiring on Sky, who jumped in to kill off what was called Project Kangaroo, which was a kind of commercial iPlayer that was between all of the UK TV companies. Sky really torpedoed it, knocked it, blew it out of the water, because they said it had dangerous competition implications. And now, instead of UK companies having more control over that stuff, everyone's going to start going off and making deals with Google. So it's kind of, you know, what Sky cut off its nose to spite its face. And we may see, you know, a couple of years down the line, it may look like they did a very stupid thing indeed.
It's certainly food for thought. Let's hope the company's executives in question are listening in. Now, both those executives and you can find more details on these stories, as well as so much more, on guardian.co.uk/technology. Now, earlier we spoke to Jan Sesnik, who's been using the Wiimote to make music. And now, continuing on our Wii hacking theme, we catch up with Johnny Chung Lee, who's been described as the god of Wiimote hacking. You can find him on YouTube, where he's uploaded tutorials on everything from how to make the Wiimote track the movement of your fingers to using it as the base for a cheapo version of an interactive whiteboard.
Head tracking for VR displays is only going to work for one person at a time. But for that one person, the 3D experience is going to be far more realistic and immersive than anything else we see in homes today. So if you're watching this and you're a Nintendo Wii game developer, I want to see some games.
He's now somewhat of a YouTube celebrity, and as a darling of the hacking community, there was congratulations all round when it was announced that he'd been chosen to be part of Microsoft Project Natal, which has been set up to bring motion sensors to the Xbox 360. The Guardian's Kevin Anderson caught up with him at the Digital Thinking Conference to ask him what made the Wiimote ripe for hacking.
As soon as I sort of got one in my hands, I read about all the sensors that were in it, and it was clear that it had several components. It had Bluetooth, battery power, LEDs, a speaker, a vibration motor, the accelerometer for motion, and then the camera. And the camera was interesting because they didn't advertise the pointing capabilities of the Wiimote as a particularly large feature of it, but the way they were doing pointing was actually somewhat novel, at least from a commercial standpoint, and even a little bit from a research standpoint. Just using a handheld camera is not that common, simply because the processing, the cost and power requirements to do vision processing in a handheld device was relatively high, and only this little camera, this company named PixArt, who manufactures the camera, was able to do it as embedded silicon. Was it cheap enough and powerful and low power enough to actually do in a handheld device? And that was actually fairly interesting from a lot of performance standpoints. And as a result, a lot of very basic computer vision work that's been done in the research literature could be done with a Wiimote quite easily and cheaply. And so part of that work was just showing people what has been done in research.
So computer vision, mm-hmm. you mentioned that, and what is computer vision?
So computer vision is the software algorithms that interpret images from a camera and try to make sense of that image, whether or not it be recognizing bright spots as interesting points of things to look at or track, to recognizing there's people in the image, or recognizing that's a scene of an outdoors, or even the fact that there are multiple people and they're talking to each other, and recognizing who they are in the image.
So you took this off-the-shelf device, realized there were some interesting things that were going on, and what did you do with it?
I decided to sort of play around with different ideas of using the sensors in interesting ways that most people weren't exploring.
So you were able to create a multi-touch whiteboard, mm-hmm. and explain a little bit about how that worked.
Well, what an interactive whiteboard is a large surface that you can interact with as if it's a large computer screen. And so what you can do with the camera and the Wii remote is place it off to the side so the camera can actually see where the screen is. And if you simply hold an infrared LED, which is a little bit like a specialized flashlight, the light is visible to the camera. And then with a little bit of software, you can control the mouse cursor with the pen that you have in your hand. And so you can actually interact with a large screen as if it was a touch-sensitive screen, for the cost of a Wii remote plus the specialized pen, which is about as complicated as a flashlight.
What are some other projects that you've seen that are really interesting with the Wiimote?
There's been a lot of very nice stuff exploring sophisticated things to do with the accelerometer. One of the nice things to do with something that's motion input is to do things that are music-based, simply because music is a very physical activity. And so the sophistication of music creation using the accelerometer has actually been fairly impressive in the tool set around them, and the fervor that the music interface community has just generating new ways to manipulate sound has also been pretty interesting. There's been some sophisticated advancements either inspired by or based off my work, where people who have know a little bit more computer vision than I do or have better exposure to the algorithms and the tool sets, they can do things like track 3D objects in the scene using multiple Wii remotes. I've seen people who have expanded on my finger tracking and tracked multiple fingers, in which case they can use their thumb and forefinger and simply pinch objects in the air and things like that. And as well as people doing sort of these light graffiti concepts where they're sort of simulating spray paint using light and projection, and also people who are doing quality of life applications where disabled people can now either somehow interact with a computer or create artwork themselves through gross motor tracking. And so they put LEDs on their wheelchair or on their hands, and they can simply wave their hands in gross motion or simply move their wheelchair around the room, and the camera can track where they are and turn that into useful input.
You know, the most common way we still interact with computers is a keyboard and a mouse.
Mm-hmm.
More generally, you know, not just gaming but other things. What do you see kind of in the future? What are the things you're working on? What or hope to work on?
As specialized computing becomes more common and more available, specialized input devices and output devices is also going to have to be explored. Simply because the old ones that we have designed for Excel and PowerPoint and Word and web surfing don't work well in those new environments. And I think something that people are really hoping for is a completely new interface to do everything. But the reality is that what's probably going to be more common is that there is an increase in diversity. And so the keyboard and mouse is not going to go away, but it will only be used for tasks which mouse and keyboards are best for. And the Wii Remote is great for gaming. It's not great for checking your email or surfing the web because an accelerometer is not that useful. But the cost of accelerometers and the cost of computation allow a specialized device to be created just for gaming. And I think that's just going to become more common. And we'll start to see new interfaces appear for new tasks.
You posted these videos on YouTube. Mm-hmm. Were you surprised about the response that you got?
Yes. Following a lot of the hobby projects done with the Wii Remote, if you do something interesting with them, they sort of register 10,000 views, maybe 20,000 views if it's a nice project. And so when I did them, I was sort of expecting something in that range, you know, 10 to 20,000. Once I put it up, to my surprise, a lot of top-tier media outlets picked up on it, and they started reaching up in the millions, which was very surprising to me.
So what does it feel like to be a YouTube celebrity?
Funny, because it doesn't feel any different to me, except now lots of strange people come up to me and say, "You're the Wiimote guy," and people ask me to autograph their Wiimotes. But I have a very geek following, and so the type of fans I have are, well, geeks.
So what about Johnny's view regarding there being an ever-increasing choice of controls for our various gadgets? Would it not be easier to have one device to control everything?
I don't know. Universal remotes, well, they're generally more trouble than they're worth, really, aren't they? I mean, you have to cope with all of the possible convoluted different things that the remote might need to cover. And people have been trying to solve it for a long time. Steve Wozniak pumped loads of money into universal remotes in the 1980s once he'd left Apple. And we're not really much further on than we were then. Having said that, yes, it would be really handy if you just had one controller that, you know, worked for your PS3, your Xbox and your Wii. But this is actually one place that all of these companies are competing on at the moment. Nintendo knew that it wouldn't be able to match the power of the PlayStation or the Xbox 360. So they did something different. They went and built a controller. Guitar Hero, Rock Band, all of these things have blossomed because of the fact that they have a different way of playing the game. If we had universal remotes, we wouldn't see the same kind of evolution that we see at the moment. So while it seems like a good idea, I don't think it's the answer.
Fair enough. Charles, what do you think about Johnny Lee Chung? Is he the exception rather than the rule? Are we going to see big corporations looking to the hacking community to become part of their team and perhaps add something that they themselves can't?
I think that if you can do something that's really interesting and really catches people's attentions like he did, I mean, his YouTube videos of ways to hack the Wiimote and things to do with it are legendary. Then yeah, you are going to come to the attention of companies which have big budgets and big plans. But even on the smaller level, you know, if you come to people's notice through the things that you do, the things that you make public, then yeah, you know, companies will always want to hire you, and it always means that you have something to point to. You can say, you know, look what I did.
So I guess bedroom hackers should start doing a bit of self-publicity.
It's what YouTube is for. They're, you know, besides Channel 4 programs.
Absolutely. Well, we'll have to check back with you both in about 2015, see whether we are in fact controlling everything with one device.
My money's on no.
Now we turn to your part of the show, where we hear your reactions to what the Guardian team has been busy blogging. Charles, what have you got for us?
Well, Bobby had a blog post about the settlement between Microsoft and the European Commission over what browser there should be in Windows 7, where essentially you'll be, when it starts up in Europe, you'll be able to choose the browser that you want to use. There's been lots of questions about, well, how should you do it? Should it be that they come up alphabetically? Should they come up in different sizes? Firefox was arguing that because it's the number one browser that's not Internet Explorer, it should therefore be the one that's most visible. Brownbat had a rather nice response to this, where he said, Hollywood has confronted this exact sort of ego problem and addressed it with staggered but equal billing layouts. I believe Towering Inferno with Newman and McQueen was the first. A list of browsers could be placed in a line from the lower left corner of the screen to the upper right. Constructed correctly, our intuitions about reading left to right and top to bottom cancel out, and no browser in such a list is, quote, first. If they're still balking at middle versus edge placement, perhaps a slight arc or subtly different font weights could compensate the, quote, inferior positions. I just love this idea.
She's had a proper think about this, hasn't she?
It sounds brilliant.
Personally, I was gratified to find Twitter being used for what it was built for, technology and food. We received a tweet saying someone's cooking up a storm and listening to the podcast. I can only hope Bobby wasn't so diverting that it caused burning of the dinner. Unfortunately, producer Scott put a gagging order on us, so we can't mention the tweeter in question. Shame. Meanwhile, over at the Digital Content blog, there's been comment outrage. It seems whilst some lucky people have been given access to Twitter's new list feature, which allows you to subscribe to others' lists of followers based around a particular subject, the majority of us have yet to be given access. Porrig said, I got a list invite, but Twitter did also say it was a trial, so I should keep it quiet. It seems they didn't count on our own Charles Arthur letting the cat out of the bag.
Yeah, well, TechCrunch had as well. Hardly as if I was the only publication in the whole world to tell people that there were lists.
And quite right too. I think people need to know about this kind of stuff. Bobby, what's been going on at the games blog?
Last week we were kind of puffing out our tests by pointing out that The Guardian had won the best newspaper games coverage at the Games Media Awards for the third year running. Hat trick there for all of us and the lovely people on the games blog. There was a swell of comments congratulating us on our clearly superlative efforts. But while I don't want to reward the trolls, there was one cynic, Claire Halley, who said, yes, you do produce by far the best reviews that are so short they're utterly meaningless. Well done. which was a very nice, very nice comment to leave. Some of the other commenters responded to her, including my favourite, Big Warv, who just said simply, Claire, you sound delightful.
Ouch!
Bit slack.
Now, as Bobby mentioned earlier, it's all change here at Tech Weekly. I've sent Bobby packing, so it's the perfect opportunity to let us know what you truly think. You can be quite assured that I've yet to become emotionally invested in any of the sections. So be bold. Tell us what you love, what you hate, and also which bits make you go, meh. You can get hold of us via email, Facebook, Twitter, and maybe by the time you're hearing this, a whole other hot new social networking site. You can find links to all of them on our homepage, guardian.co.uk/techweekly. All that remains is for me to thank our guest today, but just before we go, we must answer the question on everyone's lips. Charles, will you be donning your glad rags for Windows 7 launch party on Thursday night?
I believe I will.
Bobby, any plans to spearhead a San Francisco party?
Well, I sent out an invite to the guys from the launch party video. For some reason, they haven't responded yet. They haven't RSVP'd. It's just going to be me and some Twiglets.
You've been shunned. Personally, I'm only just getting over the Vista party I went to in 2007, so I am out. And that's it. Join us next week for a full debrief as to how the launch went down, as well as a plethora of other technological highs and perhaps even some lows. Until next Tuesday, I'm Susie Weezer.